Well, now that we've heard all about the nature of our problem and what we might do with the bureaucracy we have, maybe we can attack now trying to make some headway in getting rid of it. Our final speaker on this part of the program is Bill Rickenbacker, graduated from Harvard. He's been in the investment advisory business for well over 20 years now, a senior editor at National Review, contributing editor, he was senior editor until 1969, contributing editor since then, editorial board of Modern Age, the executive committee of the Conservative Party in New York State, author of a number of books, including Wooden Nickels and Death of the Dollar. And most importantly for what we're doing here today, he's chairman of the National Tax Limitation Committee. And that name of that organization explains exactly what he's going to talk to us about. Bill Rickenbacker.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be with you today, and especially to share the platform with two distinguished gentlemen, one of whom, Bill Niskanen, is part of the brain trust that will guarantee whatever success we manage to achieve in the tax limitation field. It's also a pleasure to break a long-standing record of Don Lipsitz. He has succeeded for almost 15 years in keeping me away from the platform of the Philadelphia Society, and I finally effected a breakthrough by coming under the auspices of something besides myself, namely this committee that we're engaged in. The committee began a couple of years ago and continues as a result of our recognition of a basic flaw in the political system. The political system that we have in this country has led to a perennial, perdurable increase in the size of government as a proportion of our ability to afford it. Government taxing and spending have been rising year after year under Democratic and Republican administrations. It is a perfectly bipartisan disease. It doesn't matter whom we elect to the executive or legislative or judicial branches, the government keeps growing. Now, when you have a manifestation of something that is centuries old, as Professor Meltzer says, you should actually look at whatever may be causing this. Professor Meltzer outlines some of the democratic systems that are at work to permit this, but there is also something else that we identify, that we address ourselves to particularly in tax limitation. That is, that the legislators who pass tax bills and spending bills are subjected to a pile of forces emanating from special interests, each of whom wishes to increase an old program or start up a new one. Whereas the countervailing political force, namely the interest of the taxpayers as a group, never gets expressed on a program-by-program basis. And our Constitution doesn't permit the voters to vote on the total size of government. Consequently, the legislator feels all the lobbying force in favor of new programs and nothing against it. A good example is the maritime subsidy. It amounts to about $600 million a year, which is peanuts to you and me, isn't it? That's a penny a day. But it amounts to $15,000 a year to the beneficiaries of the maritime subsidy. This explains why, for instance, the maritime unions are willing to put up $200,000 to finance the Carter campaign and why they lobby mercilessly in every session of Congress. This happens in program after program until there are thousands of programs at work and the government keeps on growing because there is no countervailing force to the sum total of the special interests and their irresistible lobbying efforts. That's the flaw, that's the mechanism at work that we're fighting against on this panel today and 365 days of the year. What are the possible answers? Well, since it is a political problem, we should investigate the political modes of action open to us. There are five. One would be the executive. We could try to elect good men to the state house, to the gubernatorial mansions and to the White House. Well, that's not practical. If, for instance, we have a candidate who promises to limit spending, we have no guarantee that he will win. once he has been elected to the gubernatorial mansion or the White House, we have no guarantee that he will come through on his promise. Once he does come through on his promise, we have no guarantee that he'll be able to persuade the legislatures to go along with this. Even if the legislatures do go along with it, what one session can accomplish, another can destroy. It will not be a permanent fix. The last half of that critique applies, of course, to the legislatures themselves. A second avenue of approach would be to work through the legislative branch, to elect good men to Congress and to the state houses. But what they do in one session can be canceled by the next. And it seems to be historically so that a good man, even if he promises to be a good man and is a good man, stays a good man only about 6 months after going into office. A third method to limit government taxing and spending would be, of course, action through the judicial branch of government. This is closed to us by the judicial branch itself. The Supreme Court has ruled over many, many years in many, many decisions that the courts have exactly no power at all to inhibit or constrain the taxing power of the Congress. A fourth method of political action is, of course, just violent revolution in the streets, and pro tem, we ignore that option. The fifth course, the remaining political weapon available to us, is, of course, constitutional law, the basic law that trammels up the powers of the executive and the legislative branches. Now, proving that the first four avenues don't work or aren't our cup of tea does not prove that the fifth avenue is going to work. Luckily, we can make a positive showing that operating at the constitutional level is not only theoretically good, harmonious with our political system, but also practical at the polls. That's why the National Tax Limitation Committee exists, in order to help groups who are trying to limit taxes through constitutional means. For instance, after a lifetime, naturally as a conservative, a lifetime spent in hopeless causes, I can stand before you today and say, in this case, we start with an absolute majority of the American people on our side. Public opinion polls show that more than 50% of almost every subcategory of the population is in favor of some kind of constitutional tax limitation. The interesting thing about the polls is that the remaining 45% of the people are not against. That remaining 45 percentage points of the voters divvies up approximately as follows. 15% opposed, that's your public employees, and 30 percentage points don't know, no opinion, never heard about it, which is of course to be expected because it's a brand new idea and it's not essentially simple, it is a subtle idea. So we start with about 55% of the people in favor, but not thoroughly understanding it, not thoroughly committed, because their intellectual grasp is minimal and initial. And then a large group that need to be persuaded simply through public education. In any case, our natural majority should be the original 55 plus some slice of the remaining 30, giving us 65, 70, 75%. As I'll mention later, that's precisely what we have achieved in at least one case. Now, starting with a popular majority doesn't guarantee that you can amend 50 different constitutions or the federal constitution, because 35 of our states require that such a proposal emanate from the legislature, and there is no popular initiative in 35 of the states. Here again, the news is good. A majority of legislators, when exposed to this idea, declare themselves to be in favor of it. That may seem to be paradoxical, but legislators are not stupid people. They are taxpayers. They can see what's happening. They're unhappy with it. They feel these pressures. They feel their own helplessness. They see themselves buckling day after day, and they're unhappy with it. We show them a way to get the monkey off their backs. As things now stand, if they refuse to increase a program or initiate a new spendthrift program, they are accused of being skinflints, of putting the almighty dollar ahead of human rights, and they're run out of office within a couple of sessions. Give them this excuse, which they will frankly use as an excuse, and they will say to the new supplicant for some new Balderdash scheme. Well, I believe that your Balderdash scheme is a marvelous humanitarian effort, but my hands are tied. As you see, the Constitution over here has specified what we shall do with the big piece of pie this year, and it's already been allocated. Now, if you can go to my friend down the street who has another Balderdash campaign, but a little money, and get some money from him, then we'll reallocate it here in the State House. At that point, you have the politicians doing what they should be doing. They're allocating a fixed piece of pie, and you change the current situation into a lovely new situation. At the moment, all the special interests gang up against the taxpayers as a whole. Put a proposal like this into the Constitution, and all the special interests will go out and fight amongst themselves and leave us alone. And I say that's a step in the right direction. Well, now to address ourselves to some practical political matters. If we start with a popular majority, if legislators are on our side, why have we lost? Because, frankly, we have lost now three times running. The idea for this originated in California, as you may know, and was on the ballot in 1973 in California. It lost in California, principally because it became the area for a personal and partisan rivalry. Originally, the Democratic Party was in favor of this proposal. Halfway through the campaign, they grew to fear that Ronald Reagan would use a success in this case to manufacture a springboard to the White House. They didn't want that. They were willing to defer the vote on tax limitation, so they withdrew their support and the proposal failed. But it did not fail entirely on its merits in that case. It was the subject of a partisan dispute. To some extent, however, it did fail on its merits. This was the first time out in the history of this country of a proposal of this type. Those who drew it up made what I think was a correct decision. They tried to paint every last detail of it into the amendment so that the amendment ran 2,500 words of extremely difficult material, and it was difficult to understand it in the first place and difficult to sell it in the second. We have now, of course, sweated that thing down to about 600 words of rather plain English, and we're making progress conceptually in making it streamlined, elegant, simple, and short. It failed again in Arizona, a project somewhat along these lines, because in the last couple of weeks, the public employees unions and the teachers' unions ganged up and covered the entire political arena with a smokescreen of falsehoods and demagogic and fraudulent complaints. And there was just no time to come around behind them, sweep up the garbage, and clean the deck so that people could know what was being proposed. It lost again there. It lost in Michigan in 1976, although a week before the election day, the Detroit News showed that 53% of the people were in favor of it. It lost in Michigan, not because there was any partisan campaign associated with it, but because, once again, the proponents were swamped by a $300,000 slush budget put up by the opposition, who blanketed the airwaves in the last 7 days. A campaign of distortion that is unconscionable in any group, but particularly distasteful, emanating from the teachers who presume to be the guide of the future. But we learn from experience, and we learn more from failure than we do from victory. Even so, with all the knowledge gained from failure, it's a delight to be able to report victory, as you probably know, in Tennessee last month on March 7th. In Tennessee, a proposal drawn up along the lines that we've been developing since 1972, carried by a vote of 65% to 35%, just about a 2-to-1 victory. It carried 95 out of the 99 counties in the state, all the eastern mountainous Republican counties, all the western flatland rural Democratic counties. It continues in Tennessee to enjoy the bipartisan support that we've discovered almost throughout the country.